The countdown to the holidays, how the numbers add up in the battle against the pandemic in Texas. That story and a whole lot more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. A new study finds a strong correlation between cancer and living within 30 miles of an oil refinery. What this could mean for some 6 million Texans in the nation's top oil-producing state. It was known as Mexico's revolution, but the impact on Texas was nothing short of revolutionary. Now, the story of the women on the front lines. And it's not just for arts and crafts anymore. Many small Texas businesses find pandemic business booming online. Omar Gallaga on the Etsy effect and more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this third day of December 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this Thursday. You know, since Election Day, a whole lot has been written and said about how Democrats' long-expected blue wave failed once again in Texas and why. But amidst all the hand-wringing, a certain reality slipped by most folks, mostly unnoticed. Until now, that is. Patrick Svitek of the Texas Tribune certainly picked up on it. In November, something happened in the makeup of the Texas Senate. It lost its supermajority. Now, that may not sound like much, but it actually means a lot. The way the rules of the Texas Senate are currently written, it takes 19 senators, that's three-fifths of the Senate, to approve legislation for a vote. And when Republican Pete Flores lost his reelection bid, well, that left Texas Republicans with only 18 members in the Senate. A majority, but not a super one. So if Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor known to use the rules to push through a GOP agenda, wants to keep doing what he's doing, it'll require a change of those rules. And the Texas Tribune today raises the prospect of him doing just that, lowering the bar on the current three-fifths rule. While most of the talk in advance of the upcoming session so far has been focused on how the ledge will do its job amidst a pandemic, you know, with Zoom calls and all that, many expect a rule change will likely be on the table and very soon. Joining us now, Patrick Svitek, political reporter for the Texas Tribune. Patrick, welcome back to the Standard.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about how this might have worked in the past. I mean, there have been socially conservative items that have been, I think hot button is often used to describe some of these issues. And Dan Patrick, the head of the Senate as the lieutenant governor of Texas, he has sort of led the charge to push through some of that legislation. Could you give us an example or a sample, perhaps, of the kinds of issues that might have come up and might be pushed through with a supermajority that could get stalled?
Sure. You know, so the overwhelming majority of the legislation that, you know, goes through this chamber, you know, there is broad consensus on it. But as you point out, there are these hot button issues, the ones that generate the most debate, the ones that get the most media coverage, that end up having very close votes when it comes to that vote to bring it to the floor. And so some examples of that, if I'm recalling correctly, was in, you know, 2017, the quote bathroom bill, which sought to regulate transgender bathroom use. You know, that was one, I think, where there was a pretty close vote on whether to bring it to the floor. And that was, you know, that was a kind of a Republican-Democrat Democratic divide. But you also see some divides in the Senate between, you know, members who represent urban or suburban areas and more rural areas. And you see those divides play out on issues of public education and what supporters would refer to as school choice. You've also seen some close votes on bringing to the floor legislation related to property tax reform. That was a big issue in the previous session. And so those are just a few examples of issues where, if I recall correctly, this vote, you know, has been close and where, you know, going forward, it would be pretty consequential if this rule were to go away on these kinds of issues, at least.
So if Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick wants to steamroll Democrats in the Senate, has that tool been removed entirely, or might he take another path to getting securing a GOP advantage in the chamber?
Right. And this is really what our story about this is all about. Back in January, while speaking to the Texas Public Policy Foundation in Austin, Patrick almost kind of went out of his way to raise the possibility that, hey, if it, in the upcoming November election, if we lose our supermajority, I may just have to push to further lower that three-fifths rule so that we go to a simple majority vote required to bring legislation to the floor. So that would be going from needing 19 members to bring legislation to the floor all the way down to 16 members. And so that way, Republicans, because right now they're heading into the session with 18 members, that way Republicans can continue basically steamrolling Democrats on this procedural move and can continue voting to bring legislation to the floor without requiring any Democratic cooperation.
Could the lieutenant governor do this unilaterally?
He cannot. This is one of the first orders of business for the Senate when they meet in January, is approving their rules. And to approve rules only requires a simple majority vote, so 16 members. And so if this is something that the lieutenant governor wants to champion, continues to want to champion, mm-hmm. And wants to push through, it could be a very real possibility. But the question is, he has not, right now the uncertainty is whether he's still committed to this. Again, he raised the issue, this idea of further lowering that threshold back in January, didn't talk about it a lot after that, and hasn't made any known public comments on it since the election. And for our story, we reached out to a number of Republican senators' offices. Majority of the ones who reached out to said they were unavailable to talk about this topic. Other ones were just tight-lipped or said they hadn't heard anything. I'm sure there's behind-the-scenes discussions going on, but in terms of the public conversation on this right now, everyone is being very cautious. And we have less than a month and a half until the session gavels in, and so that the days are really ticking down to see whether Dan Patrick's still committed to this. It's what would be a very bold procedural maneuver.
Watch this space. Patrick Svitek certainly is. He's political reporter for the Texas Tribune. We'll link to his latest, texasstandard.org. Patrick, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Public health experts had warned the holiday season would be a dangerous time, with colder weather forcing people inside and with holiday gatherings. It was expected COVID-19 cases would spike in Texas, and that they have. Now that we're well into the holiday season, KUT Austin's Ashley Lopez reports on what the winter could bring.
Aliza Norwood is a physician and an assistant professor at Dell Medical School at UT Austin. Even though we've been dealing with the coronavirus since March, Norwood says where we are at the start of December just isn't the same.
We are in a different phase right now that is very, very concerning.
Norwood says the medical community in Texas has been ringing alarm bells for weeks. And now, with COVID-19 cases on the rise, she says the situation is even more dangerous.
There's evidence of more community spread. So whenever you are gathering with people, because there's more community spread, there is a higher risk that somebody in that cohort that you're gathering with may be exposed to COVID or have COVID and not know it.
And if behaviors don't change, Norwood says there's going to be a strain on hospitals. Medical staff will have to focus more of their attention on treating COVID patients, while other illnesses get less attention. And as more people get sick from COVID, she says, there will also be more deaths.
As a primary care physician who is caring for people who have had loved ones die or who themselves have been sick in the hospital, it's just completely devastating to individuals, to families, to the community. So seeing that, up close and personal, I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
This is why policy experts hope individual behavior will change. But they also want the behavior of state and local officials to change. Luis Figueroa, with a policy think tank called Every Texan, says he wants to see the state working more collaboratively with local officials in the state's big cities and counties.
There is no question that cities and counties, particularly urban cities, were on the front lines of trying to determine how to contain, this global pandemic and continue from spreading. From the get-go, it would have been ideal for there to be a clear understanding of what role cities and counties could play and what role the state would play.
Figueroa says the lack of clarity has made it harder for local officials to respond to outbreaks. For example, when to further restrict indoor gatherings, what to do about schools, and when to consider fully locking things down.
So we're believers in letting cities and counties set their priorities for things like that based on data-driven policy.
But state officials haven't seen it that way. Governor Greg Abbott has said flat out there won't be another statewide shutdown. And even when cities like El Paso have tried to shut down during a disturbing surge in cases, they have been met with a lot of resistance. Abbott has said that's because he doesn't think shutdowns work.
There's an overestimation of exactly what a shutdown will achieve. And there is a misunderstanding about what a shutdown will not achieve.
Abbott says there are also financial and mental health consequences associated with lockdowns. But Luis Figueroa with Every Texan says there's a cost associated with state and local officials going back and forth on this stuff. He says efforts to shut down El Paso are a good example.
We saw that in the Rio Grande Valley earlier in the year, where the hospitals became completely overrun and the state wasn't taking enough action to address the situation. So many lives could be saved if we'd work with our local communities and instead of trying to fight them over power and authority.
Figueroa says a lot of what's to come depends on how the branches of our government react. So far, though, there continues to be tension. Recently, Governor Abbott accused local officials of not enforcing the restrictions they already have available to them, like limiting capacity in bars and restaurants.
Some local officials are not using the tools that are available to them to make sure that they are taking every step they need.
So if they're not using the power they already have, Abbott said local officials don't need the power to do more. But Figueroa says this is not how things should be handled moving forward, especially as cases continue to rise.
That's not working together. That's pointing fingers. And that's what we need less of.
And despite how state and local officials behave, public health experts emphasize what comes next also depends on how individuals behave. That is, whether people socially distance and wear masks in the coming weeks. In Austin, I'm Ashley Lopez.
Standard Zone's Shelley Brisbane, who normally covers tech, is covering Wells Dunbar, monitoring social media statewide on this Thursday. Howdy, Shelley.
Howdy, David. Well, if you're suffering from election fatigue, I'm here to tell you that there are still some undecided races in Texas. This is first day, I'm sorry to tell you, it's the first day of early voting for runoffs for county and city and school board elections all across the state. Mm-hmm. Election day is December 11th. But wait, David, there's even more. There are a couple more special elections coming a little later in the month. On December 19th, voters will decide the Texas State Senate District 30 race between Drew Springer and Shelley Luther, the Dallas salon owner who famously refused to shut her doors when Governor Abbott said that she should early in the pandemic. Yeah. The governor endorsed Mr. Springer earlier this week, which has created a lot of dust up in that race.
I would imagine it might. Yeah.
It's a very conservative district. Both of those candidates are absolutely Republicans. And the governor has taken his side.
And the governor, of course, has been trying to balance his constituency, especially in the middle of this pandemic. So got a lot going on there. We'd love to hear what's on your news radar, Texas. Or I should say, Shelley would. She's monitoring the talk of Texas. And she's going to be joining us once again in about 35 minutes or so as the Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Last month, a nonprofit lender began offering low-cost, small-dollar loans to people with poor credit or no credit in Texas. It's an alternative to lending services that often come with high costs and high risks for borrowers. KERA's Christopher Connolly reports now on the arrival of a lending alternative, even as more Texans are struggling financially.
Even before this recession, Andy Posner says the economy wasn't working for a lot of people. He founded the Capital Good Fund in Rhode Island right before the 2008 recession. And since then, he says, more people have fallen into greater debt to payday and auto title lenders, pawn shops, and the like.
The size of the predatory loan industry more than doubled during the time period where the economy and the stock market have boomed. So clearly, it hasn't boomed equally.
Capital Good Fund is a distinctly non-predatory lender, offering reasonable loans to low-income people who don't have great credit, folks who are working but can't save enough cash to handle a minor emergency or take advantage of a new opportunity. The fund offers two different types of loans in Texas. One helps cover immigration costs, and the other is a short-term crisis relief loan of up to $1,500 that has a 5% interest rate.
People are using that for rent, utilities, Wi-Fi bills. A lot of people are buying iPads and the like because their kids are going to school on Zoom now. And, you know, vehicle repair and things like that.
A typical payday loan can cost 100 times more in fees and interest than the small loans that Capital Good Fund offers. And the way payday loans are structured sometimes forces people into a debt spiral where they have to take out another loan to pay the first one off. Car title loans are a little bit cheaper, but one in six Texans who took out a title loan last year had their car repossessed because they couldn't pay the loan back.
We view our role to be able to be part of that rebuttal to the argument that if you rein in predatory lending, people will have nowhere else to go because we are one of the alternatives.
Oh, it's a staggering difference.
Susan Hoff is the Chief Strategy and Impact Officer for the United Way of Metropolitan Dallas, which helped bring the Capital Good Fund to Texas.
To have an alternative that's a viable alternative that has an interest rate that is fair and reasonable that people could pay it back is an incredible opportunity for our community.
Because too many workers earn too little to make ends meet, Hoff says predatory lending fills a need. In the Dallas area, only a quarter of 25 to 35-year-old workers earns a living wage.
People using predatory lenders are not doing so oftentimes just for a crisis. It's like multiple times, sometimes 8 to 10 times a year to get enough money to make it through, you know, one more month and then going back again.
Andy Posner says he knows Capital Good Fund helps fill in the gaps for people. But ultimately, he says that's not good enough.
Candidly, in an economy that worked well, we wouldn't need to exist. I mean, first of all, no healthy economy should necessitate people borrowing $300 to $500. They should be earning enough money. There should be enough affordable housing. There should be upwardly mobile jobs so that people have that liquidity. The fact that they don't is not a failure on the part of our clients. It's just a systemic failure.
And this winter, things could get a whole lot worse. People have been racking up debt to keep their families whole and housed, and a federal eviction moratorium is set to expire at the end of the year. So the possibility of a small loan that won't trigger a spiral of debt may have arrived just in time. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider. Proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. When life gives you a pandemic, one way to make lemonade is to open an Etsy store. That piece of 2020 wisdom from our tech expert Omar Gallaga, who wrote recently for the local news site Third and Lamar about Austin business people who found a new home at the online craft marketplace Etsy. He's here to tell us about it. Omar, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, David.
Some of the people you talked to for your story were selling products in brick and mortar stores before the pandemic. How did they make this transition to Etsy, and what did they tell you about how they're doing?
I think some of them are using Etsy as their main marketplace, as their main storefront, and others are kind of adding it to a lineup that might include Instagram or their own website. But I think what we're finding this year is that Etsy has really emerged as a major e-commerce place. I mean, this has been around since 2005. Mm-hmm. We kind of associate it with, you know, yarn and crafts and people kind of making things at home. But I think even larger businesses that do custom work, businesses that do, you know, face masks, things like that, are finding that Etsy is just a really good place to get seen, to get your stuff out there and get new customers.
And you write that many of these sellers are actually artists who might typically be selling their goods at crafts fairs, especially those built around the holidays. I'm thinking of something that we have here in the Texas capital city, the Armadillo Christmas Bazaar, for example. Are those events still going on at all since the pandemic?
Yeah, some of these events where local craftspeople are either going virtual, you know, they're kind of directing people to their, you know, own Etsy stores or storefronts, or they're kind of really scaling it down to make it socially distanced. So, you know, that limits the number of sellers that can be in one place. It limits crowds. So some of these events are going on. Some of them are going online. But, you know, definitely the sellers I talked to all said that in lieu of that, they're really getting a lot more traffic to their online and their Etsy presence. They're really seeing a surge. Especially over the holidays, as people are starting to shop for custom gifts and more personalized items.
You mentioned things like masks. I would guess that pandemic-friendly items like face masks are pretty easy to find on Etsy. But what about other categories? Any stand out as doing especially well right now?
Yeah, I think Etsy sold something like $350 million worth of face masks in its second quarter. I talked to a gentleman who learned how to sew and started a business called Kaiju Cut and Sew with Japanese fabrics and has been doing an amazing job just offering very unique designs. But, you know, apart from face masks and crafts that you would normally see, I mean, I talked to a person who is doing custom lighting solutions, sconces, you know, custom lighting stuff for your home called Light Crafters. And he's been in business for, you know, 20, 30 years. But is using Etsy as a place to attract new business and get people interested in his designs.
How do you promote your product, though, on a platform that has become so wildly popular? I mean, it's easy to get sort of lost in the shuffle, I would guess.
Yeah, I mean, what I heard from sellers is just have a unique, good product. I mean, I think if you have something that's really different, that has a very unique design, it will stand out from the crowd, even if it's something that's a very common item like face masks. I think it's the key is having something that's eye-catching that people will see stands out from the crowd and really doing a good job promoting it. It's not just promoting it on Etsy. It's also promoting it on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, wherever people's eyeballs are and getting them to that storefront.
I have to admit, I was a late adopter when it came to shopping on Etsy, but when I hit it, it was like, whoa, this is pretty cool.
There's
have you shopped
cool
on
stuff.
Etsy?
Oh my God, yeah. My daughters are obsessed with it. They look at jewelry on Etsy. They look at you know, gifts for their friends for the holidays. I mean, there is some really cool stuff. And what you really see on Etsy is, you know, people who are home, you know, during the pandemic and are looking for ways to express themselves and create new things. I mean, Etsy is where they set up shop, you know, when they want to sell these items that they're learning to make or if they've been established, you know, in crafts. I mean, that's where they go to sell stuff. So, I mean, you find a lot of neat stuff there.
It's gotten to be big business, and business is good, especially during this pandemic. Tech expert Omar Gayaga keeps tabs on the online world over at techminutetexas.com, and you can read all about it over at thirdandlamar.com, too. We'll have a link to his latest. Omar, thanks so much for stopping by, and we will talk with you again next week.
Appreciate it. Thanks, David.
Happy shopping.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network that has been caring for Texans for more than 30 years. More than 55 physicians in the Austin area treat 26,000 cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. More than 1 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines could arrive in Texas in the coming weeks. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott says the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has agreed to provide more than 1.4 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccines to the state this month. He says the first shipment of vaccines should arrive the week of December 14th, with more expected in the coming months. According to the state's distribution plan, healthcare and frontline workers, as well as vulnerable populations, will receive the vaccine first. Last month, Texas became the first state to surpass more than 1 million COVID-19 cases. Hospitalizations and deaths also continue to rise. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
I-35 in Austin claims the title of the most congested roadway in Texas, according to an annual ranking the Texas A&M Transportation Institute released last week. It edged out the West Loop in Houston, which has held the top spot for the last 2 years. David Schrank is a senior research scientist with the Institute. He says while highways in smaller cities, such as Waco and Brownsville, ranked in the top 100 for gridlock, 95 of those roads were in either Austin, Houston, San Antonio, or Dallas-Fort Worth.
So it's not just a metro problem. It is other urban areas as well. But when you just kind of look at the magnitude of big traffic congestion, it tends to be in those four large metros.
The 2020 rankings are based on data from last year and do not reflect traffic patterns during the pandemic. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to list the peppered chub as an endangered species and designate portions of rivers in Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and New Mexico as critical habitat. The minnow-like fish was once widespread in the Arkansas River and its tributaries. Michael Robinson with the Center for Biological Diversity says that's no longer the case.
The peppered chub is now reduced to one remaining population that is in a stretch of the South Fork of the Canadian River that flows from New Mexico into Texas.
Robinson's group filed a lawsuit earlier this year to protect the peppered chub and more than 200 other animal and plant species. U.S. Representative Michael Burgess of Louisville conceded his bid last night to be the Republican leader on the House Energy and Commerce Committee. He lost to Kathy McMorris Rogers of Washington State. San Antonio Democrat Joaquin Castro is also vying for a key role in the U.S. House. He's facing Gregory Meeks of New York for the chairmanship of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the University of Texas at Dallas, where 4 million square feet in new or renovated space has been added in the past decade. More at utdallas.edu/bright. UT Dallas, moving at the speed of bright.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texans who live close to an oil refinery are at an increased risk of getting cancer, according to a new study out of the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. While other studies worldwide have shown toxins emitted by oil refinery production pose a high cancer risk, this report out of UTMB finds a clear correlation between cancer cases among Texans and how close they actually live to an oil refinery. Stephen Williams is chief of urology at UTMB Galveston. He's also a professor of urology and radiology at UTMB. Dr. Williams, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Just to be clear here, this isn't exactly determining causality, right? I mean, this doesn't say that the oil refineries were the cause of these cancer cases that you examined. What this study shows is that there is a correlation between where you live and the location of these oil refineries. Have I got that right?
Correct. So this is an observational study and actually an experimental design of which you cannot derive causality. Important as well is that the data that were used at the zip code and county level and are not individual level data.
Having said that, tell us a little bit about your methodology. How close are we talking about here when it comes to living close to an oil refinery?
Absolutely. And that's definitely an important question. And we looked at individuals living within 0 to 30 miles within an oil refinery in order to decrease the potential confounding of living farther from an oil refinery.
You studied over a considerable amount of time, right? I mean, you were looking at number of cancer cases. Was it 2001 to 2014?
2010 to 2014.
2010 to 2014.
Correct. And we derived all the cancer cases from the Texas Cancer Registry during this time, which culminated a little over 800,000 cases. And importantly, also used the U.S. Census data, which then culminated to over 6 million
so
individuals.
So statistical significance here, finding that what? How many of these cases seem to be among people living within that 30-mile, I guess it would be a sort of radius?
Correct. So we found increased risk across all cancer types that were assessed, and these cancers were selected either for their prior biological underpinnings, increased risk of potential carcinogens that may be emitted from these oil refineries, or are either one of the four most common cancers diagnosed in the United States. And what we found were an increased risk of cancers across all cancer types of those individuals living within 0 to 10 miles from an oil refinery versus those that live within 21 to 30 miles. Importantly as well, we also were able to determine increased risk of burden of disease, which was measured by the extent of the disease at time of diagnosis.
So you're talking about, for instance, advanced cases of cancer is what you mean by that, right?
Correct.
And it's important to note here that when you're looking at that 10-mile radius, you're talking about a greater percentage of people living in poverty, right?
There are, but what was interesting is actually when we did our Poisson regression analyses, and more importantly, when we controlled for socioeconomic status, we continued to find an increased risk of cancers of those individuals living within close proximity to an oil refinery.
It's my understanding that there's some 6 million, give or take, people who live within 30 miles of an oil refinery. You stress that this is not determined causality. However, what are individuals to make of this and their own personal dangers that they might face if they live within the radius of an oil refinery in Texas?
Well, that brings an important question because I actually do live within that radius, and wow. It really hits home. But basically, it provides a moment for pause. You know, anyone here is my wife, you know, she, you know, heard of these results before. And, you know, one of the things is it causes, you know, a concern. Some people, at least as I've seen it in social media, you know, one response is, duh, doesn't this seem to make sense? But no study actually really has determined this. It does support, and something that we are definitely going to look to is individual level investigation. Now, the risks are not 2 or 3 times or even 50 times increased risk. We found subtle differences or significant. It was significant, but increased risk of proximity to oil refinery. But that also, too, needs to be clearly delineated. And I think what will be critical is that we have partnerships with the oil refinery industries themselves, and really critically evaluating these data, but then also any other particular data that they may have, so that maybe we can actually perform matched analyses and looking and then determining really, is there a significant increased risk?
But it is almost certainly going to be looked at in the months and years to come. Stephen Williams is chief of urology at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston and a professor of urology and radiology at UTMB. Dr. Williams, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Well, thank you very much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed Podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Much has been written and told about the men of the Mexican Revolution, which started around 1910 and continued for a decade, transforming Mexican culture and government. But what about the women who played a major role in this important period for Mexicans and Texans? A new book out this week aims to bring the stories of those revolutionary women to the forefront. Kathy Sosa is one of the editors of Revolutionary Women of Texas and Mexico, Portraits of Soldaderas, Saints, and Subversives. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you. We're so excited.
I understand that you are a San Antonio-based artist and educator. What was the inspiration for this book?
Well, to tell you the truth, inspiration struck me like lightning in about 2009. I was at a folk art shop that I love, and a guy that I had just met by the name of Lance Aaron gave me an essay that talked about what a great impact the Mexican Revolution had on the place where we live here in the Texas-Mexico borderland, because it drove so many people northward to the United States, mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands, maybe upward of a million.
Wow.
I found that incredibly intriguing because both of my husband's grandmothers had come to the United States during the Mexican Revolution alone with no man but with small children. I said, you know, have you ever thought that this might be more than just a random coincidence that both of your grandmothers arrived during the Mexican Revolution with little kids?
So enormous ties to this period of time. But why focus on the women? I mean, I think something, as I was doing a little bit of reading here for our conversation, I didn't realize that women actually had quite a role in Mexico's military, a much greater presence, it seems to me, than perhaps they had in the American or the U.S. military.
Well, where that comes from is that it's a revolution. So the revolutionary armies are not regulation armies. They are militia groups that grow up and go out to depose Porfirio Diaz, and they have no supply lines. They have none of the things that a regulation army would have. you know, they wouldn't have been able to fight that Revolutionary War if their wives and girlfriends, sweethearts, hadn't come along to make their food, wash their clothes, and sometimes pick up guns and fight, and sometimes become military leaders in the effort.
And so in many respects, the Mexican Revolution was not just a male-led thing. It was also a women's revolution.
A women's revolution, yes, because women got to, well, I'm acting like it's a privilege, and it was romanticized, but it was terrible. It was war. It was awful. You know, it was brutal, and there was death, and there was starvation, and there was all kinds of trials. But women stepped up into roles that they hadn't had before, and those roles are becoming better known. And in that sense, it definitely was a women's revolution, too.
Who are some of the present-day women that you recruited to tell the stories of the women whose stories are told in your book?
We're really, really proud of our contributors. Sandra Cisneros, who's, you know, a well-known and world-renowned author, has contributed two essays, one on Teresa Urrea. Laura Esquivel, who wrote the novel Like Water for Chocolate, which was made into the coolest movie on earth. If anyone hasn't seen it, they need to watch it now. Uh-huh. She contributed a chapter on La Malinche. And La Malinche is a really, really fascinating character because she was the translator for Cortez, who aided in his conquest of the Aztecs. So she has been reviled as a quote-unquote traitor, which she wasn't, because she had been sold into slavery by the Aztecs. And she's also been revered as the mother of the Mexican identity, which is that combination of the European and the indigenous.
This is not just a book about revolutionaries who were part of the Mexican Revolution, but in a sense, the ongoing revolution continued certainly in the south of Mexico.
Yes, you're exactly right. So the core of the book has 18 subjects. The core of the book, the center of the book, are stories of women from the Mexican Revolution and Cristero Rebellion. So that's 1910 through 1929, let's say. But then we asked ourselves, well, who are the women in our collective DNA who would let us know that we had the courage, we had the genius, we had the creativity when we need to summon it up and change the society? And so we look back into the pre-revolutionary period for figures like La Malinche, like the Virgen of Guadalupe. You can bet that Latin America and Mexican Americans and Latin American descended Americans wouldn't be as Catholic as they are if it were not for her. And then the post-revolutionary period, people who you know, we are not still alive today, but who are fighting the civil rights revolution in our country and blazing new ground for writers or people to express their sexuality, their gender, their politics. Yeah, so we decided to say, you know, talk about the spiritual mothers of the people, the women of the revolution, and the spiritual daughters of the women of the revolution, who look back to them for the wind under their wings.
Why do you think it's taken so long for the stories of the women of Mexico's revolution to be told?
I think because there has been a gender bias in favor of quote-unquote great men and their biographies, which is what made up history for the longest time. And from a Texas perspective, looking at why we haven't recognized the impact of this huge Mexican migration and this huge number of women who came, it's also an ethnic bias. So, you know, I was really surprised when we first started investigating this idea that it's not really mentioned in the Texas history books. You know, if you're a little girl from here, if you're a Latino from here, you don't you don't read about that in the time period that's covered in the Texas history book. It's almost like it didn't happen. And our friend and contributor, Sandra Cisneros, says, if you don't tell your story or your sister's story or your mother's story, it won't be told and it'll be like it didn't happen. It's very late for us to be realizing this, but it's not too late to write it into the Texas history book so we can read about it in the eighth grade or whatever it is in Texas history, so that it's not just World War One, and it wasn't just Mexico's revolution because it changed the face and the future of Texas.
A revolutionary read. Kathy Sosa is a San Antonio artist and educator and one of the editors of a new book released this week, Revolutionary Women of Texas and Mexico, Portraits of Soldaderas, Saints, and Subversives. Ms. Sosa, thanks again for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
I was happy to. Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Hydrogen is the most abundant chemical substance in the universe. It's also famously explosive. Does the name Hindenburg ring a bell? But our understanding of that element and how to safely use it has come a long way since that famous disaster of 1937. Now hydrogen is an emerging player in green energy, with some scientists optimistic it could be a key player in reducing carbon emissions that are damaging the planet. And Texas, already a major producer of both wind and solar power, may also be well positioned to break into the up-and-coming hydrogen industry. So writes Chris Tomlinson in his latest for the Houston Chronicle, where he's a business columnist. Chris, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Great to be here.
First off, let's talk a little bit about what hydrogen is actually used for. I'm thinking of hydrogen fuel cell buses, but even those are sort of one-offs, I guess, not really in that widespread a use. Maybe I'm wrong there, but what does the future of hydrogen demand look like?
Well, hydrogen has many, many uses beyond that fuel cell. It can be used in the same turbines that natural gas is used in to generate electricity. Hydrogen can, be used to make ammonia, and then ammonia can be used as a liquid fuel. That's what's so exciting about hydrogen right now, is that there are many different applications in gas form and liquid form, in many different technologies.
Well, I'm curious, what about Texas specifically gives it an edge, as you see it, when it comes to an emerging hydrogen market?
Well, Texas is the largest producer of hydrogen today, because hydrogen is needed to make textiles. It's needed for fertilizer. It's needed for rubber. But right now, we mostly make it from natural gas, and that's why they call it gray hydrogen, because there's really nothing green about it. Making hydrogen in that old-fashioned way actually creates more climate change. It doesn't fight it or mitigate it. What Texas can do, though, is take power from wind and solar, which we have plenty of, and use that to make hydrogen, and then it becomes blue hydrogen. And that is something that we can be proud of and sell into the future.
But of course, whenever you're dealing with some kind of new form of energy, you've got a time frame involved for scaling up production. What is that looking like? Are we talking years or decades before this becomes more widespread?
Well, the biggest hurdle for hydrogen is that it's about three times more expensive than a lithium-ion battery, or four times more expensive than diesel fuel or jet fuel. And so the trick is to bring that cost down. And we're seeing literally billions of dollars being invested in new companies and new technologies. There's some great research going on at Rice University. So it may take 5 to 10 years to actually bring the price of hydrogen down. But the exciting thing is that, if we can do that in 5 or 10 years, then we could have a completely zero emission electric grid. We could reduce our our requirement for jet fuel and diesel fuel. It's all about the technology and the innovation now.
Is there, and I'm thinking of the economic incentive to invest here, because if you imagine the next, say, ExxonMobil of the hydrogen world, is anyone poised to do something like that, or are we still ways away, a good ways away from that?
Well, you know, Exxon, it wants to be the Exxon of the hydrogen world. Shell Oil is spending, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars on hydrogen fueling stations in California. Air Liquide, one of the a French company with its North American headquarters in Houston, is working on creating green hydrogen that is made with clean energy and no emissions at all. So, you know, it's the big boys in the energy industry that are going to lead the way on this. And that's kind of what's so exciting about Texas, is that, you know, there is a place for us in a clean energy future. We're not just all about natural gas and oil.
Something is coming to a fuel station near you. It's almost inevitable. You can read all about it in the Houston Chronicle, where Chris Tomlinson has been writing about the future of hydrogen as an energy source. He's business columnist at the Houston Chronicle. Chris, thanks again. Good to talk with you.
Great being here.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. You like that TexasStandard.org thing, right? Well, in large part, that's thanks to our web editor, Shelley Brisbane, filling in for Wells Dunbar on this Thursday. Howdy, Shelley.
Howdy, David. Those web posts might take a little longer to get up today, but we're doing our very best. We have able assistants on the team.
Yes, so. Caroline Covington, I know you're thinking
Absolutely.
Of her and others.
Hard.
Mm-hmm. So what are you looking at? What are Texans talking about today?
Well, you've probably heard about the California politicians who got in a little bit of trouble for dining out, despite the fact that they had some pretty stringent COVID-19 regulations. You heard about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a Texas version now. The mayor of Austin, Steve Adler, he took a little vacation earlier in November. He took his family to Cabo San Lucas after hosting a wedding for his daughter in Austin. And that's caused a little bit of a kerfuffle because the mayor originally said that he had done everything right and his family had taken precautions, including antibody tests. But subsequently, after quite an uproar, he's apologized for it. And our friends on Facebook have a few thoughts. I thought you might like to hear that.
Yeah, let's hear what they have to say.
So Manuel Leslie says, I have stood up for Adler, and I considered his handling of the pandemic, among other things, to be fantastic. Until now, this is not defensible. Tim Bauerkamper says...
I was going to say, correct me if I'm wrong here, Shelley, but it was my understanding that he was calling on Austinites to sort of batten down the hatches, stay home, all of that, while he was away.
But that's right.
It wasn't clear that he was actually away while he was making these calls for Austinites to stay put.
Yeah, this didn't come to light until this week, and he was apparently out of town when he was saying in early November, stay home, because Austin was experiencing an increased rate of COVID at that time, as it continues to do. Mm-hmm. So his constituents have some things to say. Tim Bauerkamper says, as mayor, he should know better. As a leader, you have to hold yourself to a higher standard. He should know that people aren't always listening, but they are always watching. Now, the mayor has taken some heat in general in Austin for COVID-19 regulations. There are some folks out there, there are signs that say recall the mayor. So there are people who have not been fans of the mayor even before this. Jeremy Swanson perhaps is one of those folks. He says, Adler is a mini tyrant and the worst mayor Austin has ever had. Ever.
Wow, that's a little strong. Strong stuff indeed. Of course, this has been an issue for a lot of leaders. There have been other officials in other parts of the country that have been criticized for what some see as hypocrisy. Of course, we'd love to know what you think about this, if it's how big of a deal you believe it to be and that sort of thing. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Shelley Brisbane, our web editor, is certainly looking for you as she continues to monitor the talk of Texas on this Thursday. We're out of time, but we encourage you to visit Shelley and the rest of the team over at texasstandard.org. Till tomorrow, I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.